We've been collecting your questions, and we'll go ahead and start asking some of those to our presenters. Please continue to put your question in the chat box. We have up to about 11 a.m. Eastern Time to answer questions, so we'll get through as many as we can in that amount of time. All right. First off, there were a number of questions that came in during Sophie's portion of the presentations that focused on a few aspects of Mayes disease, some clarifications. So I thought I would go ahead and ask those first. Dirk Stryker asked, are the hybrid varieties of maize in East and Southern Africa more susceptible to disease than the land races of West Africa? Higher yields but greater vulnerability.
Thank you, Julie, and thank you, Dirk. Absolutely, truthfully, I'm not a plant breeder and I'm not going to be able to answer this entirely fully. I can mention that there is very little difference in some of the hybrid varieties in East Africa and the local varieties susceptibility to aflatoxin. What we have seen is that the varieties that the cover of the maize cob is open at the end are more susceptible because more moisture gets in and there's more access for spores to sit on those ends, and that's where you get higher contamination levels. Absolutely. Again, I don't know whether Andy has any better knowledge on this, but I don't think there's been a lot of research on the West African races versus the South African or the East African hybrids. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm not aware. And this is Andy. Yeah.
Great. Thank you. And there were two questions that came in from Patrice Hakizimana, who asked a couple of questions about maize lethal necrosis. One was, can you explain whether crop diseases like MLN in maize may cause harvest loss but not health hazards as mycotoxins such as aflatoxin, or do they also cause health hazards? And then also, how efficient will investments in MLN control be without resistant maize varieties available for farmers?
Well, in Southern Africa, we looked at this question a little bit, and as far as is known, there aren't real health risks related to maize lethal necrosis, but there needs to be a lot more research. There's some concern that it might cause mycotoxins in the plant materials that are left. Sophie, do you have perspective on this?
Sorry, thank you, Daniel. Two aspects. MLN is a plant disease. It kills the plant. It doesn't have residue that's left that will contaminate human food in any way that will affect the human consumption. And Daniel is right. If you leave the residue in the field, it's quite possible that the viruses that are propagating there, then it's easier to spread to the next fields and everything else. But there isn't an interaction with human health. For your mycotoxins, the funguses that grow, as they grow and propagate, they deposit this toxin, and that's what's poisonous, and it's a byproduct of actual fungal growth, and it's just a toxin that's deposited and is contaminated. In terms of looking at the different varieties and looking for MLN resistant maize varieties, that is going on at the moment, but in any variety development, it takes years to look at the different maize strains, do the plant breeding, process through, check that it's MLN resistant in controlled areas that doesn't actually allow that to spread, and then to look to see whether it has the right climatic conditions to grow in the areas where the disease is. And this disease is spreading over all climatic conditions in Eastern Africa. And then finally, does it have sufficient yields to actually make it marketable on the market? So it's surveillance and control at the moment is the more viable solution, and Kenya and Uganda have been fairly effective at this point of finding it, destroying it, and spreading and preventing it from spreading too far. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you, Sophie. As long as we're discussing maize and maize disease, a question just came in from Margaret McDaniel. One of Daniel's slides said that there is a regional standard for aflatoxin in East and Southern Africa. Can you, Daniel, discuss this a little bit further, please? What are the regional standards for what crop and for what end use?
That's an excellent question, Margaret, and there is not a simple, easy answer for that. The regional standards are being organized through COMESA and SADC, the Southern African Development Community, some of which have overlapping membership, of course. And what they have generally done, those regional economic communities in their SPS committees on which each of the national governments is represented, they have gone with the CODEX standard, which is 10 parts per billion for maize. There is a standard out there of 15 parts per billion for groundnuts as table nuts. These standards are not binding regional standards. They're more guidelines that the COMESA and SADC countries are essentially affirming that CODEX provides, which is through based at FAO in Rome and is recognized by the WTO, is the standard-setting body or a standard-setting body throughout the world, and that these standards are acceptable within each of those regional economic communities. But each national government retains sovereignty over their SPS rules and can impose a higher standard if they wish. So the regional standards are still at the national level. You bring up the interesting question, Margaret, about different uses. This would be one of the really good areas for helping the national governments and the two RECs, or the RECs throughout Africa, to delineate what the acceptable standards for aflatoxin are based on usage, whether it's for human consumption, whether it's for animal consumption, which type of animal. From the research that we have done in our three regional reports, the larger the animal, the less susceptible to aflatoxin they seem to be. The older the animal, the less susceptible. Dairy and certainly breeding animals are considered amongst the most susceptible. So this is an area that really could be fleshed out much more in the future.
So, Daniel, there was a question coming in from Frida Movici, who works for the Soybean Innovation Lab in Mozambique, and who stated, on my last visit, I noted a growing market for poultry byproducts, such as gizzard, liver, and heart, dominated primarily by women. Recognizing this as a cheap source of animal protein within the informal market, do you have any suggestions on how SPS can be addressed in low-end markets?
Well, it really is nice to be amongst a community of researchers who pose very probing and interesting questions, because this is an area that certainly gets into product differentiation, and many places around the world are very different than the U.S., which for poultry meat prefers the white meat. The organs, the offal parts, are very much prized elsewhere around the world. And I think it's a positive sign if the kidneys and livers and other organ meats are being sold on a separate basis. Each of those has a separate SPS risk. I'm wondering if where Frida has seen these being sold, whether or not the cold chain is being guaranteed throughout the process or even at the point of sale. There are a lot of sort of basic common sense things related to SPS and food safety that in the U.S. there's a great deal of information out there through the USDA and FDA about food safety techniques that consumers and certainly marketers can use. And I would say that it would be a combination of how to improve the system would be the marketers and retailers and the cutters, the butchers of these poultry, understanding where the critical control points are. We talk about HACCP and what are the investments they could make to make their products safer and then to gain a reputation for safer products, and also for those private sector people to reach out to the government officials and say, am I meeting the standards? And, what are your programs to help me and what can I do myself? So starting a dialogue about food safety in these, poultry parts markets.
Thank you, Daniel. Let's see. There was a question I think I'll send over to Sophie about giving an update on the actual African countries currently affected by maize lethal necrosis, and that was from Seydou Samake.
Thank you for the question, Seydou. According to CIMMYT's latest information, currently MLN present in Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Tanzania. That's where it's known to be present. The surveillance has been going on in Malawi and Zambia. They were using tests, which only test for one virus, but on the grounds that if one virus is not present, then they can't have maize lethal necrosis. Those surveys that were done earlier this year showed no sign in northern Zambia and northern Malawi. So the emphasis that needs to be redone regularly each season that they have maize production to ensure that it isn't spreading further south. Thank you.
Great, thank you. I'm going to just test one more time and see if Andy's voice is coming through. Andy, if you're there, will you speak up?
Yes, I'm here.
Excellent, wonderful. A couple of questions came in during your presentation focused on livestock, and so I thought I would just fire off two of them quickly from Dick Tinsley. How much of backyard poultry tends to be scrunch feed, and how long does it take to get marketable with some major tough meat problems? So it sounds like he's wondering if feed affects meat quality, how does that ultimately affect marketing or food safety? And just also a curiosity about branding on cattle. Most cattle he's seen have massive brands on them, perhaps not coated, but definite scars. And you had mentioned no branding on cattle. So wondering if you could clarify a bit about that.
Okay. Thank you. And thank you, Dick. The short answer about the diet of the backyard poultry is that I don't know. We didn't get into a lot of detail about this. I think the main point was that as far as we could find out, there was very little in the way of maize being consumed. And I think that Dan made this point. Therefore, the aflatoxin threat to the that part of that poultry value chain was very limited. In addition, something which may go contrary to the assumption on which the question is based, it seemed that there was a very positive preference amongst many people in West Africa, certainly under certain circumstances, and I'm thinking of being in restaurants, for the albeit tough but tasty backyard chicken. And I did not get any feedback suggesting that there was a problem with it. It was actually actively preferred under those conditions to the more, perhaps more succulent farmed chicken. So that would be my reaction to the first question. And then I've lost the second question, just a second. The branding. I think it's a confusion to do with the two meanings of the word branding. I wasn't using branding in the sense of branding cattle. I was using branding in the sense of branding perhaps the meat, the supermarket branding that would apply, and so that a supermarket would have an interest in defending the quality associated with its brand with respect to its consumers. And that would mean an interest in up the market chain, what was happening, and knowing through traceability where that steak was coming from. The means of traceability might involve branding in the other sense, but I haven't got into that, haven't thought that through in any great depth. I'm afraid that's all I have in the way of response to those two questions.
That's great, Andy. Thank you.
All right.
A broader question came in response to the various slides that all of you shared about investments that can be made in SPS. And this is a question from Dirk Stryker again. It's easy to specify various recommendations for improving the situation, but where should priorities be placed? So The problem is that successful implementation of these recommendations requires substantial changes in institutions, trade mechanisms, etc. Do you know of any testing on the viability of different approaches for using randomized controlled trials on any of these recommendations? Or, if not, do you have any comments on the priority level of certain investments? So this is something that everyone can weigh in on. Daniel, would you like to start on this one?
Sure. Dirk Stryker is kind of the secret shopper, I think, because both Andy and I have a long relationship with him, and appreciate the question. I would say that they're really, in terms of aid effectiveness, or what under the British Development Agency, DFID, they call value for money, I don't think there are a lot of good ways to determine which are the best approaches. In the recommendations that we're making, we tried to have both large and small, both bite size, that perhaps a small bilateral donor agency might address, or a foundation of some kind would see an interest in, as well as larger scale ones. And also having recommended investments at both the national and the regional level. What is being suggested is that, it's very important to monitor the effectiveness of these different approaches and try to learn from them for the future activities that might be undertaken.
If I can add to that, this is Andy. I think one thing that the study in West Africa didn't do is get a detailed understanding of what all the other donors are doing. And this may be partly repeating what Dan has just said. I think within a coordination of with other donors, it would probably be transparent that the other donors were covering quite a lot of these things, which would limit the options. It would still have a prioritization problem, but perhaps not such a big one. I think it's also a question of short-term against long-term. It would be nice, certainly, to make some investments in improving regional and national institutions so that if they become stronger, then the some of the problems or the equivalent problems in 5 years' time would be fewer and less severe. On the other hand, obviously, and maybe this is a bit simplistic, but I'll say it nonetheless, in the short run, if emergencies come up, they have to be dealt with so that people can be fed. Thank you.
And one of the things that we had discussed, just to chime back in, was that many of the most significant reforms in SPS systems occur due to food safety incidents. If you will, scandals. In South Africa 10, 12 years ago, it was found that the peanut butter being given to the children in the school feeding program was well above the permitted level for aflatoxin. And this led to significant reform within South Africa's sector. And as far as I know, they stopped serving peanut butter to the children. If the peanut butter is safe now, maybe they can reconsider.
Right, thank you. Sorry, Dirk, I just wanted to add something on the randomized trials. AfterSafe has been extensively tested, firstly laboratory, then controlled trials, and then randomized trials on farms in various areas. Another randomized trial that happened recently was carried out by IFPRI in Kenya, where they looked at the effect of different post-harvest practices on aflatoxin increases 3 months later. So they had traditional drying of maize, then they had it on plastic sheets, then they had it using the Easy Dry M500, and then they had a small trial with the hermetic bags. That showed that using plastic sheets, impermeable plastic sheets, reduced the increase in aflatoxin by 26%, the dryer reduced the increase by 77%, and the hermetic bags reduced the increase by 95%. So yes, there have been randomized trials, and then looking at the economics of those different interventions is also included in some of the literature. Thank you.
When Sophie is talking about the hermetic bags, those are bags that were developed as part of the cowpea or niébé protein crop sector for West Africa. They're called PIX bags or Purdue Improved Cowpea Sacks. And they have the traditional jute bags with then two layers of plastic bags inside. And while this was found to be quite effective at preventing weevils from getting into the cowpeas or niébé, I believe, Sophie, it's been shown that they're very helpful on maize, and they're doing testing to see if these PIX bags will be helpful on groundnuts.
It's not just PIX bags. Any hermetic bag will prevent aflatoxin increase. What you need to look at is its resistance for insect penetration from outside. The Aspergillus simply goes dormant when it's in this low oxygen environment. When oxygen comes back in, the Aspergillus then reactivates and starts growing. They have been trying hermetic bags with groundnuts. It's not been as successful as it has been for the non-oilseed crops as yet, but they're still working on it. It has to be a lot drier.
And I think one of the things I've certainly learned from you, Sophie, is that in storage, whether it's maize or groundnuts, the levels of aflatoxin often have the tendency to increase in storage when the crop is just piled on top of each other and care isn't taken to aerate it properly, or to, it's a complicated thing.
Aflatoxin does increase in storage, and the concept that reducing the moisture to below 13.5% would stop aflatoxin increases works for some strains, but there are strains in Kenya that quite happily propagate at 13.5% moisture and less at 25 to 90% per month increases. Julie, back to you.
Thank you. It's great to have this conversation back and forth between our presenters who are joining from wildly different locations. It's exciting, and thank you for that those responses. All right, we have about 13 minutes left for Q&A, so we'll chug right through a few more. One question came in from Indra Klein. About the cost of seed. How does the cost of seed affect the manner in which farmers can adequately grow and protect their crops? What strategies are being developed to facilitate farmers' ability to leverage these costs? This seems like a question for Andy.
I'm not sure I have an answer to that. I'm still trying to find the question.
Yes, it's the second one in our Q&A box, our private presenter Q&A box.
Thank you. I don't think I have an answer to this one. I have to be honest. I'm sorry. This is outside my area of expertise.
Well, I could take a stab at it.
I can say a few points. So I think the cost of seed and whether farmers will adopt it is very dependent on how active the market is in terms of actual access to market. So if you look at the Kenyan market, particularly in the North Rift areas, we have moved from fairly low levels to approximately 96% of the smallholder farmers up there now use hybrid seed because the yields are so significantly higher than the local varieties. If you move down into eastern Kenya, though, although almost every farmer still uses some hybrid seed, they tend to have up to 5 varieties on their fields. And this is because they're using strategies because the hybrid seed needs more water, but they could have a climatic problem with lack of rain, so they also plant what their local varieties that they think is more resistant to drought. As you move around, so Kenya is one of the more sophisticated seed buying and seed producing countries in the region. As you move out from there, you move down into northern Zambia. There's been low seed adoption, which is changing now. Again, as that market drives the security that you can sell your product, your ability to invest in knowing that you have a market at the end increases. And so your willingness to buy seed increases? Thank you.
Yes, the question of what type of seed does a farmer plant is a key economic question throughout Africa. Hybrid seeds are generally available, but whereas most African countries don't offer pre-harvest finance, the farmers need to have the money to purchase the seeds. And any programs that are designed to encourage them to adopt new seed varieties, improved varieties, you know, certainly the first year, if you give it to me, I'll plant it. And, you know, hopefully see that, you know, there's greater yield and less pest resistance. I think one of the conclusions from our research is that the improved and hybrid seeds are generally more resistant to aflatoxin and fumonisin and other plant diseases. And there's research through CIMMYT and IITA going on to try to develop MLN-resistant varieties or identify which varieties. So the choice of seed in terms of the ultimate impact on SPS and food safety is a key element. And I think most farmers do it by sense of touch with his or her sense of which ones are going to be most profitable. And as Sophie said, you know, it's kind of a survival thing, strategy of going to plant some of these that I paid for and then some that I saved from last year, the open pollinated varieties.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have, recognizing that we only have about 10 minutes left, I think it's a good time to go and pull up a few of our ending polls. We'll hope you stick around for another 10 minutes, but recognizing that a few people might need to take off, please go ahead and take these poll green, which will help us shape and improve our future AgriLinks webinars. All right, a few more questions in our queue here. This one that I'll go ahead and direct to Sophie from Numeri, which is groundnut seed treatment with some permissible chemicals an option to control aflatoxin prevalence?
Thank you, Julie, and Numeri. The IITA is currently trialing AfriSafe with groundnuts. I know it's being trialed in Malawi to see whether it will be an effective mitigation method there. I know that there were trials with fungicides trying to treat the soil and the crops that were not particularly successful. So not a great, not a huge answer, but it's on its way.
And as long as we're on you, Sophie, I think that you maybe answered this in the chat box, but it would be good to call it out since the question came up again, which is a question from Randy Shackelford, a question regarding the use of M-Reader by mobile assay from Colorado in countries other than Zambia for quicker, less expensive aflatoxin testing. He has used this testing method in villages without electricity and had results in approximately 15 minutes, which is pretty exciting.
Thank you very much, Randy, for that. There's a new exciting development also from ICRISAT, which has just been launched in Malawi, where they also have a portable field trial where the response is, I think, within 10 minutes and costs $2 per test. The other countries that have used the mobile assay, I know Kenya has used it, and I'm pretty certain that Kenya has used it as well, but it hasn't become very popular yet.
All right. And then a topic that always gets brought up in, I think, food safety and trade discussions is that of GMOs, or genetically modified organisms. And Dirk had asked about the speed of developing greater resistance to disease might be increased with recent advances in genomics. It's very important because the use of these varieties is likely to be more cost-effective. But what resistance have you seen because of concern over GMOs? And why don't we send this one to Daniel?
This was one of the things that we studied as part of the Southern Africa SPS report. And we have four target countries under the Feed the Future, Malawi, Mozambique, South Africa, and Zambia. South Africa, there is a whole procedure for approval for the planting of GMO crops and the marketing of them. And that is, I would say, the predominant type of seed used in the soya sector and in part for the maize sector as well. Interestingly, the other three countries, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zambia, each to varying degrees, is less accepting or not accepting at all of GMOs. We were able to do some preliminary analysis, or, you know, on the given the time permitting, about that GMO acceptance. You know, this is a question certainly in both East Africa and West Africa. And, you know, Sophie, Andy, do you guys have perspective on the GMOs?
No, it didn't come up in our study, although we weren't asking specifically about it.
In East Africa, there is still significant resistance to GMOs, and it's not an area that, while I think Kenya has just recently started GMO trials, there is still huge feelings against it, even though they're not necessarily useful in terms of productivity. Thank you.
And even in South Africa, the market that has, you know, been more accepting of it, there are certainly in consumer retail outlets products that say produced without GMOs. And so those products attain a certain cachet and are perhaps able to command a price premium for not being GMO derived.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, I think I'll go ahead and take the facilitator's prerogative to ask one last question for our webinar today. And that is a question that I'll direct to Andy, which is, are the SPF standards for livestock realistic? Should standards fall at the highest level of Codex, or should we be trying to hit lower quality markets first? Is there a, you know, a standard for how we address these standards, or a recommendation going forward?
I don't think we've got to that stage yet, Julie. West Africa, where I was doing the field work, has got a situation where the two regional economic communities, ECOWAS and UEMWA, each have a set of regulations about SPS, but they've not been able to enforce them. So that you've got diversity across countries, and then you've got the problem when the countries promulgate whatever laws they are going to implement, they propose to implement, which may not be the same as the regional norms. Then there is a difference between that implementation and the national norms. So you get to a situation where there's such a diversity and mixed up set of norms that it's very difficult to work out which is most appropriate. It would be good if the two regional organizations could, as they're planning to do and have been promising to do for the last 5 years, could harmonize their regulations and then get down to the nitty-gritty of coming up with regulations and standards which could then be evaluated. I suppose it would be possible to evaluate across the different standards that are in practice being used between the different countries. We didn't do that, and I particularly was only gathering information for the two Francophone countries, and I believe that differed from the information that was being collected by my colleagues in the Ghana and Nigeria. So I'm afraid that's a bit of a no. We don't have any information really at the moment.
Julie, I think it's an interesting question. I think if you look at the trade of livestock going out of North and Eastern Africa, so your Somali, Sudan, and Ethiopia, where that livestock is down on hoof and being shipped out live into the Gulf states, I think it's very relevant. Their standards are, you know, you need to meet their standards since it's their big market. I think there's potential then for, you know, Kenya, as it grows its meat industry, to also target that market. And being able to have an external market that you can supply initially allows us to then have the volume of meat in country as the urban population's economic growth grows as well. And then the standards come into line, you know, maybe the standards are then going to be higher for the East African trade, and so that keeps the commodity in East Africa rather than necessarily going to the Gulf. It's something that needs to evolve. I think standards should not necessarily go to the very tightest standards straight off. It's very hard to take somewhere like Kenya, where we're looking at maize between 0 and 10, 10 and 20, 20 and 50, and I've got maize at 500 and 1,000. Now, that definitely needs to be removed from the market. But as Daniel was saying earlier on, the flexibility in the standard that would allow different areas for it to go into, so at 300 parts it can go into beef fattening, we need those standards to be a little more flexible than they are at the moment. Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you, Sophie. And we have reached our official end time. I'd like to extend a sincere thank you to our three presenters for being so on the ball with the questions as we're sending them around. So thank you very much to Sophie, Andy, and Daniel for your excellent contributions and presentations.
A real pleasure.
An even bigger thank you to our attendees. You are the reason that we hold these webinars. We appreciate your contributions in the chat box, your questions, and we hope we got to the bulk of those that were in the chat box today. I'd like to remind everyone that by virtue of registering for and attending the webinar today, you will get an email in the near future. With that, we really appreciate your attendance. We always appreciate your comments. You're welcome to email me or email AgriLinks with further comments, and we hope to see you at future AgriLinks webinars. Thank you very much.